time opening.
We have an eye, sort of a nostril, two teeth. One of the teeth has a small cavity.
Close call, folks, but I think we got here just in time.
Presented by Maria Menounos and Kevin Undergaro, this is Anatomy of a Movie. In-depth discussions and breakdowns of various movie titles. And now that you've seen the movie, let the dissection begin.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Popcorn Talk Network. We are here doing Anatomy of a Movie dissection for the 1984 film Amadeus, directed by Milos Forman. 1985 Academy Award winning for Best Picture. And
I'm going to say, I forewarn everyone out there, I'm sorry if I just start miming my fake conducting capabilities. That's all this movie makes me want to do.
It's totally okay. I'm your host, Marissa Serafini. Joining me, I have the lovely...
Hi, guys. This is Sarah Stratton. Glad to do this kind of blast to the past 1984 film.
Absolutely. And it's currently February for us right now, which means Academy Award month. So we wanted to do an Academy Award winner.
I think Amadeus also speaks more to that. I think it's a film that I was really happy to revisit. I haven't watched this movie in years. I loved it. The first time I watched it, and I'll tell you guys a little bit about that in a second, but I think that it's so funny to see how what movies draw attention and what people can kind of randomly be drawn to. Because Amadeus, when it came out, was never, it wasn't a top grossing film. Like, the films of 1984 that were top grossing were like Ghostbusters, Beverly Hills Cop, Indiana Jones, Temple of Doom, Gremlins, The Karate Kid. Amadeus was not hitting box office numbers. Also, like, studios weren't really keen to invest in it. No. But when it came to award season, people loved it. People were in awe of it. It was nominated for something like 11 and won 4. It was just looked at as such a masterpiece, and I think it still is. And it's like, you look at this year and we see other music films coming to the forefront, and you talk about stories like Whiplash, which is a very music-driven film. Then you have all these biopics that continue to come out, whether it be looking at kind of a historical fiction of, like, Imitation Game, or if you're talking about Stephen Hawking and his depiction, which is, like, just diving into another genius. And I think there is a fascination there about looking at people's lives, historical or fiction or whatnot, that have some sort of spark to them, created some sort of change. And for Amadeus, part of the appeal for me, not only is remembering that although this movie is fiction and obviously it's elaborated on and so much of it comes from point of view, which makes it great,
right,
there's also the center core of, like, what's so fascinating is this man who did exist and had such a talent and a shortened life that was just so interesting. And I think that always brings you back. And, like, the fact that his score could, or his music could provide the score for this movie and still be strong and still be compelling and still tell a story, I think is fascinating.
Yes. And, Sarah, I know you're a big fan of Amadeus. You were the one to suggest this particular film to dissect. What about this movie really attracted you to it? What do you take from this movie?
Well... I think that I really wanted to revisit it and talk about it again because I've been finding one of the coolest things I think people can do with film is finding a different point of view. And for me, Amadeus really did that. I remember the first time watching it, I was younger and I was really interested in, like, classical music. And I was like, when you enter with Salieri, I thought that he was going to be... I didn't know a lot about Mozart, so I thought he was going to be my lead. I thought he was the guy that I was going to be rooting for. I didn't expect to be led through a story by someone whose point of view was more or less the villain. Whose all their thoughts were so skewed. I loved how he did all of his rationalization for everything that happened with religion, but it was all just, like, twisted, and, like, everything where the audience was the one being like, that's not how things work. Someone didn't die because of you, and some, like, all of his justifications were so interesting to me. And then on top of that, that as the audience member, I was the one responding because the priest never fights him.
No.
The priest never fights him on anything he says. No one ever does, except for maybe a little bit the wife. But it's all from his mind and his twisted, warped perspective. And yet the audience can still sense right from wrong. So how that took this story, the mix of flashbacks, these two dominant male leads working together just completely differently, though, their characterizations, everything I thought was done really well. What about you?
I really liked it. And you mentioned the first time you watched this film. The first time I watched this, I was younger. I was in grade school. But I was at the point where I was forced to watch it in school for music class, for choir. And we were going through Mozart period. And I remember I think I was just too young at that point in my life to understand it and really, truly appreciate it as I would as an adult. I just recently watched this movie again. And because the first time watching it, I remember not liking it, not taking a lot out of it. But the second time around, being older, being more appreciative of music and everything that just goes into filmmaking, I really enjoy this film. And I can understand why it won 1985 Best Picture. And we will get into it. So, yes, I thoroughly enjoy this movie. I like classical music. So to see a story about Mozart, which both of us were not around for, I think it's always fun how people revisit a story that, even from someone else's perspective, it's interesting to make up your own interpretations of what went down and everything that went on.
I know we have also JTE here, and JTE, you're in the booth, but I know you like this movie, so I kind of want to know what draws you to it. What made it one of your favorites for a while?
I caught this much later in my film geekness. I saw it in school, I believe, also like during film school, and not really understanding at the time because I think it was a high school class. It wasn't until I graduated college and I was like, I got to revisit this movie because I don't think I was ready for it the first time. Mm-hmm. And I got so much more out of it. Just like Marissa said, the undertones, as far as like the main core of the story is like, you know, Murray's character wants to be this great composer. Mm-hmm. Yet he dedicated his life to it, and he can never be as good as Mozart, who he sees as like a buffoon. He sees him as this guy who's kind of, crass.
He sees him as a toy of God used to manipulate
voice of
his
God.
His story.
But he's angry. He goes, why would God give this a guy like this, who's very crass, loud, annoying, brash, why would he give him this gift when he feels like he deserves it more than this character? And it's all about envy. And I did not get that the first time I saw the film. And I think those undertones it's so thematic in the way they use Mozart's music to express it. I mean, it's a masterpiece of a film, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I liked how the Salieri portrayed that, because seeing all the jealousy and envy between him and Mozart, but just seeing his character, how he was able to interact with Mozart for all these years and still have that facade as a companion in the music and writing, but slowly underneath is that slow burn, like always trying to defeat him in a way, which I thought that was an interesting character aspect.
Definitely. I think that both of the lead actors in this were nominated, and he won for Salieri.
Yes.
But they were both nominated as lead actors, and that goes to, I think, their character choice, which one was for him, that he did hold such a front up when dealing with him for all those years, and the manipulation and the embrace of madness in his old age. All of these were just, his monologues were delivered really well. You could tell he felt such love for the music, but at the same time, such hatred for the man who made it.
For him, yeah.
That was done so well. And then if you look at Tom's role as Amadeus, for me, what really sold me on him was the addition, whether it was his choice or the filmmaker's choice, of the laughter. His braying laughter, which to me, the arc of just his laughter alone throughout that film is so interesting, because we are conditioned to think if someone laughs like that, there's something automatically off. Like, they're either loony, or they're not right, or they're going to be comedic relief. But that was kind of the, that was, like, his biggest glimpse into that, that we saw. And then by the end, he, like, dies with that laugh. And you realize that it's just, it came from such a joy and such a childishness that he never was able to fully live, because he was just exploited as more or less a dancing monkey. And so he, the innocence that he held on to, mixed with, like, the desire for more, the love of his music, he just had such a little unique perspective, and you get mad at him for being irresponsible, but you do feel pity for him, which is foreshadowed in the beginning by his father, who says, it's not his fault, it's my fault, how I was raised. Mm-hmm. And you do learn to kind of be tender to him and to feel bad for him, even though realistically he is not helpful to his family. He is very selfish, and he doesn't grow up. He doesn't grow up. He just, in the end, it's, you know, any money he's going to get will fall straight through his fingers. And they show that. They show that in a frame where it's just the money just slipping through onto the ground. And so I thought that they both just had really strong character choices. And they impose each other so well.
So well. And I think, you mentioned the laughter, which it was that, yes, again, that braying laughter that was so a character trait throughout the whole film that for me personally, it bothered me. I don't know if it bothered anyone else, but I think that the point was that I think it was my question to you. Do you think that was Salieri's perspective of the laughter, that Mozart could have had just a regular laugh, but because his character, Salieri, really didn't like Mozart, he exaggerated how bad the laughter was. And it was something to use against Mozart, like a character trait, like you can't stand him. And then to something to, you know, hate against and have disdain against Mozart. Because that laughter carries throughout the whole film. Mm-hmm. And it even ends the film because it personally, internally plagues him. So I feel that was a character trait only from Salieri's perspective.
Interesting. I never really thought of it that way. I do like the daunting notion of, I agree with the daunting notion of, that is what his strongest memory of him. Like, that's the sound besides his music that he carries with him, is that laughter. And in the end, they merge. His laughter is not even just a laugh, but it's almost a mixture of notes. Like, each one does seem to, like, be on some sort of melody. And so I like that notion that that's what's staying with him. Whether or not that was his perspective, or just, I think that it was how he laughed, or in this world, I think that he was this braying laughter, because you could see that that's why certain other people loved him, and why, and even when he would walk into the room and he would start laughing, he would get strange looks, not just from Salieri, it was from multiple people in the room.
Right.
And if you looked at his relationship with his wife, Stanzi, that was very crass and young and juvenile, whether it's, you get their intro scene of him speaking backwards to her, and he's like saying, I love you, but it's just so vulgar. And I feel like the laughter just plays into all of that. It's just this reminder that we can see this man be in such a serious situation and in front of royals and the emperor and everyone, and yet he's not going to stop with this childish view on the world. He can't help it. People can't help how they laugh, and he can't help who he is.
Right. And I think his laughter came, because every time he laughed, it was in between a statement that someone didn't, like, take well to. Or it seemed like a laughter of insecurity or nervousness in that way, how some people laughed just to fill that dead, awkward space of dead air. So I think it was also just Mozart's character that, yes, he's such an intelligent, talented man, but socially he's not all there, and he's not the best human being in a way that like he can't be taken seriously, even though he's so talented.
And yeah, and that's true. And then when you look at the two of them together, the pair of Mozart and Salieri, it's that both of them are a little off. Mozart doesn't take things seriously enough, and Salieri takes things too seriously. but they both share this continuous love of music, which keeps you wondering who's going to win this fight or who, if Sawyer is going to achieve success, because they both can recognize this love of sound. That's what propels them forward the whole time, is this music. This music that, when it comes through the score, it attracts both of their attention. Mm-hmm. And I think that draws the audience in as well.
What do we think of Mozart's personality throughout the whole movie? Because we see he's very childish, mm-hmm. and whatnot, and again, he's talented. But do you think everything he does, like with writing and how he's arrogant towards the world, do you think that was just how Salieri's perspective of Mozart was, that he was cocky and mm-hmm. he demanded music, and especially that one particular scene is like, why do I have to show some of my written work just to pretty much audition for this role to be that teacher and to fill that post to get payment? What do we think of his character being arrogant, even though he was so talented?
I think that comes from the perspective of the film, and that whenever we were in the presence of the more or less insane asylum, I felt that anything that was said in there was truly Salieri's perspective. When we did get to the flashback sections of the film, I do take those as being truthful to the situation, because we include scenes that Salieri was not a part of. Mm-hmm. So since we get to see those other instances where Salieri is not in the room, that, I think, tells the audience that this is what really happened. This is, you can see everything, so you know what's going on. Versus, like, I think that when you're alone with Salieri, like, those are his words, his truth, and it's very monologue driven, and it's very this twisted perspective about what God has done to him, what Mozart is doing to him. But I think that when you get to see the actual events taking place, I do think you can take those for what they show, as that is the truth they're representing.
Yes. And you know, I like that we're kind of going back and forth between each lead man, because this movie is really about these two guys. Mm-hmm. And so for Salieri, what do we think of his perspective? Because we see him always praying, and mm-hmm. he has faith at the beginning of the movie. Mm-hmm. But as events progress and things aren't going his way, when he's praying and he's not getting the end result he wants, he starts to lose his faith. And then he blames God to the point where he even burns the crucifix, which was hard to watch. What do we think of Salieri and his just downward, I don't want to say evil, but darker path?
I think it's first of all, kind of terrifying to see someone flip a switch like that and be mm-hmm. able to fully declare that they've become an enemy of who they once were. That is very interesting. More than that, one of my favorite things about the storyline of Salieri is how they make this story, why it's relevant, why he's telling it. And that is all because of the priest who comes and asks for a confession. And it gave me a reason for why he was telling this. This wasn't just like a mad old man being like, I'm going to relive to you my whole past. Like, it was like, you asked me for my confession. You're telling me you think I'm a murderer or whatnot. This mm-hmm. is the actual story. And you're a man of God, and I'm going to tell you that I was once a man of God. And this is why I'm not. So this is kind of what I think of you, and now you can figure out what you think of me. And the fact that, yeah, it takes him a while to tell it, a full 3 hours in the director's cut. But all of his words serve a purpose to who he's telling. Mm-hmm. I really liked that fact, this movie, because it's very easy to be like, I'm just going to tell this to my orderly who's taking care of me. But like, it just added another layer for me, which was representative of how they did this whole film. Like, there's so much purpose. There's so much purpose into their scenes, or who they were talking to, or why they're motivated to speak, why they're motivated to share. And so Salieri, I feel like he'd been bottling up so much and just reached the point where he's like, I can tell you this whole story. let's see how you take it. And it's really put back on that priest and that priest's reaction shots throughout the film. And his reaction shots built on the fact that he doesn't ever really respond.
Yeah, no. Salieri doesn't give him the mm-hmm. chance to, because he just keeps going. I like that. I like the whole stringing, retelling, mm-hmm. kind of is like reconciliation in a way, telling your past sins mm-hmm. and what's your penance. And he didn't, his penance was always, I feel at the end of the film when we get Mozart's laugh, it's like he will always feel bad about what happened to Mozart and what he did to Mozart. But his perspective is that kind of justified in a way that's like he had his reasons, and I don't think he ever really turned back to God in the end.
Oh, no. 100% no. He didn't. I don't feel any remorse from him except for remorse of the loss of music. And that's literally the only thing I think he's sad about, and the only thing that he made him happy as well. He didn't have really any other senses of joy unless you include the soprano opera singer that he was like in love with, who he seemed to like at certain points. Which mm-hmm. also, I'm going to use that to lead into the supporting characters yes. in this film. Which to me, it's interesting because a lot of the supporting characters are very over the top.
Why do you think that is? Do you think it's because there's a theatrical aspect in their lives, that everything is grander and it's in front of an audience? People are watching them and they're constantly in the public eye. Or do you think that was just the time period that they lived in?
Honestly, I don't really know. I was trying to figure out why it worked for me as I watched it. Because normally when people, I'm talking about Sanzi's mother, who is extremely, like, theatrical and mm-hmm. animated and shrill. Or the maid, who's played by Miranda from Sex and the City, which cracks me up. Who's, like, always, like, crying and overdramatic. Or all of the royal court, besides the emperor, who mm-hmm. are just scoffing 100% of the time. Like, everyone's personality is pushed so far. Like, they're put in such like little like boxes. Like, this is the shrill landlady. Like, it's their whole character is summed up by like one line. And that normally to me is a big turnoff. Like, I want to see people with layers. I want to see that they can have a range of emotions. And I, with all those characters, I knew how they were going to act in any situation. But I think the reason it does work is because of what this is drawn from, which the inspiration is this music that lends itself to opera, to theater, to these ginormous melodies. And I think that if you're heightening the score so much and the sound and the emotions are so high, then when you're adding in these people that are also just big personalities, they complement each other. Because mm-hmm. the whole thing kind of does play off as a play, as a theater piece, as an opera. And so I think that's where those characters are set in, and they complement. Which is interesting because it's rooted in someone, and it's rooted in Salieri, who in his flashbacks is more subtle and is theatrical in his present.
Yes, and very composed as a character himself. A side character, or like that's actually big main character, it was his father, the Mozart's father, mm-hmm. Leopold. I loved how they portrayed him, because I believe the first time we see the actual father when Mozart's an adult mm-hmm. is when they're on the staircase mm-hmm. and there's the big grand violins music, pretty much like his opening, his welcoming stage yeah. Character that I really enjoyed, because in even the blocking in that scene, he was up on top of the staircase where Mozart was down, so he had his superior figure to him and cloaked in black.
It's the exact same image that you get to see in his opera yes. later with the ghost, like the way the cape opens, everything. It's the mirror image.
Yeah, it's such a dominating character that even that type of grand gesture can make the audience understand where Mozart came from, what his authority figures were mm-hmm. in life. Like, he always had someone to work up to mm-hmm. and to please. And I understand, like, everything he's done, why he was so good at music, because his father pretty much mm-hmm. instilled it upon him, which I really liked how they portrayed the father, because he even wrote an opera about pretty mm-hmm. much his life and having the character. And if you see, if you're watching us on the videos, you can see our graphic behind us, the black figure, which I really liked. It really added to it.
Yeah, it's the shadow. The shadow that's always lurking over him. I thought the father did a very good job. Just, you know, stern, commanding, and a great accent to the loving, adoring son that he has raised. On top of that, so I love that addition. I wanted to talk to you a little bit, and probably JT as well. I think I've only ever seen the director's cut of this film, mm-hmm. which is over 3 hours, and that's an additional, I want to say, at least 20 minutes on top of the theatrical release. And so for me, I tried to look into more of what I got to see versus what people originally saw. And a lot of it has to deal with plot lines about him not being well off with money. Like, a lot of that was reinforced right. with scenes that have been cut. So the original audience didn't really get to see how much he was struggling with money. Or, like, they knew, but it wasn't as pushed mm-hmm. in their face as many times. Also, things with Sanzi had been cut out. I believe the entire scene where she goes back and removes her clothes for him when she's trying to get her husband this job, all of that is not in the original cut or in the theatrical release okay. cut. And that's so interesting to me, because I felt like that storyline really made her character worth investing in.
Yes, that's really interesting to say, because I believe I've only seen the director cut as well. So now knowing that her a big chunk of her character was taken out and people didn't understand, it really understands her character in that. So knowing that, what do you think of her whole character arc in a way, from the beginning where she's a somewhat meek companion mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. Mozart, but in the end she's now being demanding, telling Salieri off and looking out for her husband. Do we believe her whole character changed throughout?
I do believe her. I liked being able to watch where I feel like in the beginning of the film she's like infatuated with him and she's very cute and it's this very cute love, and in the end it's this kind of tragic love where she's missed him so much and knew he was bad for her, but she just couldn't help but love him. Mm-hmm. And that leads her to, and she constantly is trying to stick up for him in her own way. At the end, it's kicking out Salieri. In the beginning, it's going to people for help against his wishes. She learns, and I do feel like I got to see her love grow, which is really, really interesting. Her as an actress in this is, I think I was talking to JT about this right before we started, is a little interesting, because to me she definitely doesn't fit like the period of what a woman would act like, I think, in Mozart's time. She's very outspoken. Mm-hmm. She's very bold and loud and always kind of being rebellious. She, you know, she's showing her legs. She's they're like kissing on the floor at the palace, so it seems. She's yelling at his father. All of these things we're led to believe was very improper.
Yes.
And she's very powerful and tries to like stand up for what she wants constantly, which I think is very interesting, because I feel like for most period pieces we get to see women in this age being very coy. Or, like, secretly manipulative. Or, like, it's always through a smile on their face. And then maybe behind closed doors when they're dealing with other women, we get to see them be, like, catty. We don't really get to see them dealing with men in this fashion. So, to me, that was a really interesting choice that they made with her character.
I also think that's why she's with Mozart. He's not like all these other gentlemen who are like all about society and rules and everything. He's this wild card. So for her to be with him totally makes sense in the movie. Because she's kind of brass for a lady at that time. Just like he's kind of like this brass kind of buffoon who's just running around doing crazy things. And people kind of love him for it. He's like a rock star in this movie.
Yeah. They're a good match. I agree. I did like Stanzi because it's always interesting to see a woman in that time period and how they should be portrayed, but how she was actually portrayed, which it's always fascinating. I want to talk a little bit about the Emperor. Played by Jeffrey Jones. I really enjoyed his character only because for a person of an authoritative figure, it didn't seem like he was always the one putting, like always exerting his superiority. It was more so like, no, these are the, this is just the politics and these are the regulations, but it wasn't in a mean way. It was just in a manner. It's like, that's just how the system works.
I completely agree with you. I feel like, as you said, he doesn't play up the power.
Yeah.
He doesn't have to be like, I am powerful. Listen to me now. He's just like, eh, okay, do this. Because everyone has to.
Yeah.
And it's such a fun take on it. Because he's not standing in this, like, regal, sharp position. Like, well, maybe he, like, hints at it a couple times. But mostly it's just like, oh, yeah, do what I say. Sounds good.
Yeah.
It's like, because that's all he has to do. It doesn't have to be authoritative. It's whatever he wants all the time. He doesn't have to be harsh about it. Yeah. And that was very fun.
I liked it because for a person of authority, you think automatically you would think that, okay, he's somewhat of a villain. He's the antagonist or like you're not for him. And I liked how he was just like, he seemed like a regular guy just in the court and that like you had to, you know, just report to. But I, in a particular moment when Salieri composed the music for Mozart's entrance, and he's like, let me play it. You know, so just to have that openness about him, that he's willing to just be a regular guy and be kind of on the same level as everyone else, I really enjoyed.
I did as well. I found him very funny as I continue to watch this movie. And I think it's all these kind of twists on what we expect to see of this movie that make it so lasting. Because I think when I went into this movie the first time, I was like, I knew about it. I knew it was an award-winning movie. I knew that people loved it. I knew it was about classical music, and I knew it was about Mozart. And what I was expecting was to see this grand story of this musical genius. And what I got was this kind of fun take on a different world where no one was kind of meeting my expectations. Mozart's a little crazy. I'm following the viewpoint of a villain. His wife is brash. His emperor is funny. And all the while, we could obviously get the beautiful music in the background. And I think it's those little kind of twists on expectations for me that made this movie lasting. Because as much as the characters weren't who I expected to be, the movie was as great as I expected it to be.
Right. Also, can I just say, like, the underlying themes of envy. I think even if you're not going to the same, you know, extent that F. Murray Abraham's character does, everyone has had that moment where you try to do something and you're having trouble doing it and you're doing your best and somebody comes and just does it right away without any problem, and you feel that little bit of like, come on, I've been doing this for a half an hour and you did it in 2 minutes. Right. And it's that kind of little envy that really, for me, it's universal. Everyone has had that moment. So when you watch, and even though he's the bad guy, you're kind of like, yeah, I get it. It kind of sucks.
But I liked how they played up to that, because there's always someone who's just a little bit better than you in real life. And it kind of just reminds me the Prestige. And they really, that film, it was always two rivals always trying to best each other. And I felt like they kind of had the same thing in this movie, even though this movie came out first, that it's always trying to be better or trying to secretly learn from each other, but still be good rivals in a way.
Definitely.
Which I really, really enjoyed.
That's a good example. I never thought of that. Yeah. Prestige kind of, yeah, that's a good example.
Yeah, always just... Because there is always someone that kind of makes you better. It's the more motivation just to strive for better things.
And like that movie, in some ways, Murray comes to the realization, I can't be better than him. He has a God-given gift, which no matter how much I train or how, even though my whole life has been dedicated, I'm never going to get to where he's at. So he kind of goes the roundabout way, the same thing in Prestige.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. And that's how I like near the end, where Salieri still, he always admits, like, Mozart, what, you know, is great, mm-hmm. is just great. And, like, he admires just the raw given talent, which I loved. Let's talk about the numbers, the actual opera numbers, because mm-hmm. there were a lot, and Mozart composed many. But I liked how this film really gives the audience perspective, the inspiration, how he got into each opera, mm-hmm. which I think a lot of people might not know. So there was a lot. I believe the first one was Don Giovanni.
Oh my goodness, there's so many references to this film. I don't have them written down, so I'm not going to be able to. My favorite part is that they kind of just, as you said, it's a slice. It's inspiration and then what came of it. Inspiration and then what came of it. And then for anything we don't get to see, that's normally the ones where they play into the scene of him reading the music and us getting to hear it, mm-hmm. which is also wonderful and beautiful to see, because I think that's one of the most fascinating things about him, is that understanding that someone can write down on paper but really hear the whole thing without having any of those instruments or voices present. To be able to build those sounds within one's mind and write them down and have them be accurate and have them be perfect. Both of those depictions, whether it was like the inspiration and then the stage view, or the this is my process, let's show the parchment and hear it in his mind. I thought both of those were done very well.
Right. I like the storytelling aspect, how when he first had the opera and then they're telling him to change things, he's like, no, it's perfect. Why have to take anything away from it? It's perfect the way it is. And the fact that, like, he has to make all these adjustments and he's not used to that, that really added to his character. Again, adding to his arrogance, like, no, I'm brilliant. Why ruin a brilliant thing? Mm-hmm. I like that added element. I think one of my favorite moments was near the end of the film, where Salieri is helping him write the music because he's sick in bed. But just that 4 minutes, because I watched the director's cut, just those minutes of him writing, like saying all the notes and all the tempos it should be in for every certain section, but how they also added it with the editing, the sound editing. You can just hear the music mm-hmm. in his head while they're writing it. I thought it was so well done. I haven't seen anything like it. I think a close second in my current mind that might have done something similar to that is like the movie August Rush. And there's a particular...
Yeah, where he like where is in the streets and...
Yes, there's a particular moment where the main character, he's writing, composing music, but he's hearing music from outside as well, so simultaneously. And it just took me back to that movie. But I loved how they visually portrayed it and how the audience heard it, too. Mm-hmm. It's great.
I completely agree that there's, like, multiple... They layer everything mm-hmm. really yeah. well. And in us hearing the beautiful music, it doesn't diminish the story of what's actually happening there, where you do see these two unknowingly to Mozart rivals kind of fighting for the same piece of music.
Can I ask you guys a question? Because you've seen this more recently than I have. I love that, if I'm correct, in the movie, not everyone is like fully understanding Mozart's like gift. Like, Abraham's character realizes this guy is making masterful work, and not mm-hmm. everyone, some people are kind of like, I believe maybe Jeffrey Jones is like, I don't know, it's a little brash sometimes, and even though he knows that he's making like some of the best music ever, he even kind of, because of his envy, he's so overwhelmed with envy, he's even kind of playing up to the fact, he goes, yeah, well, you know, he's not the best.
Yeah. I think there's even more to that. Yes, it is said in multiple ways that Mozart is everyone knows he's talented, but he does have, at the time, like, flops. Like, some of his shows don't do as well. Some of that's on part of the audience. Some of that's part on Abrams' character, like, saying, like, I purposely did not let that show run more than this many times. And then there's also the layer of normally he, the emperor or someone of a higher rank will say that it has too many notes or that it's just too much. And once someone of that authority says that, he kind of has to fall in line with what they say. And it's kind of like, this is the opinion that rules all. We all have to follow suit. And then in private, when asked, like, if he liked it, he would say, he would truly admit that it was marvelous to Mozart. So he wasn't envious enough to hurt Mozart by being like, no, I hated it, which would have crushed him. He was always honest when he asked him directly and alone about how he felt about it. The only times where he would manipulate his answer was in the presence of the emperor, which I think has two functions. One, ranking. Two, of course, it helps for him to agree with him. It helps diminish Mozart's capability. So I think it functions in both ways.
Because the little friendship they did have was because Mozart felt like he was the only one that understood what he was doing. Because he was, you know, not as good of as... I mean, Mozart pretty much says, you're not as good as me, but you understand what I'm doing.
Yeah.
More than some of these other people.
Yeah, and it's also, there were the added elements that... Because we know Salieri is a good rival, there are always moments where he was trying to hinder Mozart, saying favoritism and always going to the emperor, be like, well, he's a great composer, yes, but there are other composers, like, to make Mozart audition to fill that post that he wanted. And then going into Mozart's place and finding out that he's writing this secret opera and then bringing that to the emperor, and even that causes an obstacle for Amadeus. So there's, like, from Mozart. So there's always, like, little added elements that Salieri is purposely trying to block.
But there's also a way that his envy functions, where that, yes, he's blocking him and creating obstacles, but he only ever goes so far. He only ever goes so far as to, he'll say things like, this guy molests women.
Yes.
He'll say things to damage his reputation as a man. He'll say things to ruin his chances of getting a job. But what he won't go so far to do is destroy the music, take the music, or claim ownership of the music, which is something that I think makes you want to kind of listen to him. Because you always are kind of, for me, I was always scared. I'm always a little scared on the brink of, like, it would be so easy. He's gotten in. He has the originals.
Yeah.
That he could destroy these. He could steal them. There's the only copy. But although his envy is strong and potent and, like, controls his life, it never gets to the point that it goes over his love of music. That still is his, like, God. That voice is still what he worships.
And that's, even though he doesn't, you know, he hates Mozart, and he's more angry at God than Mozart.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, he still loves, like you say, he loves music, so he can't rob the world of that beautiful music. But the relationship that's really destroying this movie is his relationship with God, because he feels like God is, you know, basically
against him
and, you know, teasing him with this guy. So it's weird. I love the parallels between that and his actual relationship with Mozart.
Yeah, and it's also because as much as Salieri tries to always try to defeat Mozart in certain ways, is that he knows he can't ever destroy Mozart's talent. Because when he went to the emperor and saying he's writing this opera and it's in Italian, but also just Mozart saying, like, this is the reason why I'm writing it. It's having composed music that no one has ever seen before. A duet turns into a, you know, like, all these things on top of each other. No one has seen that. And that is where Salieri can't win, because even though he tried to block him in that way, it's just Mozart's just so talented, no one's going to stop him. And that's what I really liked it. I also, with all just watching all these different operas throughout the film, I really liked the aspect how they brought the realization and the realistic factual elements for that time. Like, I didn't know that they couldn't have ballet in an opera because it's not technically opera. That's just not the customs. And I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, their attempt to really stay true, both, I mean, despite a lot of the fictitious storylines, but with, like, settings and with music and with policy. All that I think is done really well. We talked earlier about production value and how that sometimes they got to revisit some of the theaters that these operas and this music was actually performed in, and add that realism. I know that supposedly, I'm not a classically trained pianist, so I don't know, but supposedly other classically trained pianists have watched this movie and say that the actual keystrokes match the note playing throughout the entire film. And when I found that out, I was like, just the effort that they put in, not the production team with how everything looked, how everyone was seated, how everyone was dressed, to the actors who spent hours a day practicing piano so that they could try and live up to what this musician had done. There was just so much effort to get precision. Because guess what? Almost no one is going to be able to tell if your piano keystrokes are correct. No one's going to be following that quickly and know the music that well. And for you to really try, I think, just lent itself to this movie and to why it has aged so well. Like, this movie was made in 1984. Mm-hmm. And so many movies get dated very quickly. And this one looks beautiful, I think.
Gorgeous. The production design is phenomenal. So, like, they shot mostly in Prague, only because they explored all over Europe for the filming location, but they picked Prague because that was the city that still looked and retained its visual elements and the exterior, the backgrounds to everything throughout all the centuries after Mozart's time. Like, everywhere else, they've built, like, commercial buildings. It has changed.
A lot of places in Europe were affected by war.
Exactly,
and Prague.
Yes. And Prague was still the most consistent in its look, even from back 200 years ago, when Mozart actually did exist at that time. So they stuck to Prague, and I really enjoyed the aspect that, like, they filmed in authentic locations, where the theater that they were in for the first opera, the Don Giovanni, that was the theater that Mozart actually conducted in that pit. Mm-hmm. So just the authenticity of the locations and everything. There were two grand pianos that they had in the film that are like, there are no other pianos like it. So there are so many different elements, like for the court, in the palace, wherever they are, on the carpets that they're walking, those are authentic carpets that cost who knows how much money. And even some of the paintings in the background and the chandeliers, that the interesting thing about the chandeliers, because those were authentic, they, in the filming location that they were in, the building was made mostly out of wood, and they couldn't support the 700 to 800 pound chandeliers, so they had to manually rig the chandeliers on top of the
wow,
which I find fascinating.
Yeah, that's so much effort. Like, for all these details they put in, I believe you're the one who told the budget was only
18 million.
18 million. And that,
you would not think that
exactly
is low.
What, that is so low. I mean, we're talking about movies now that had like 180 million because of visual effects and to make everything look great, and this movie was only made for like $18 million, which, like, a lot of like indies are like made for nowadays.
Yeah,
and they were going through all the city. This was filmed on location, this was filmed in theaters. You're talking about chandeliers being accurate, talking about carpets being accurate, pianos, all of this. And they must have been very frugal and very precise on everything they wanted.
Yes, some of the, to add to that, like, cabinets and tables were, and the gold and silver, just like the objects that Americans haven't seen, you can only find them in Europe, so like real pieces that really added to the film and just the overall look. And just watching it, it's such a grand scale that you can tell it totally won for best art design. Which I loved visually, and I loved the colors of it. It was so bright and you can feel like royalty, and even if you're in a theater, it's just like it's so grand and in your face. And that's what I love about theater, because it's so vivid right in front of you. It's interactive and really helps the audience, you know, enjoy whatever they're watching. Which I definitely feel this movie really hit the nail on the head.
This movie, I mean, we've been talking about it now for almost an hour, and like this movie has lasted a very long time to still kind of be on people's mind of a classic, a wonderful film. But when you're talking about money, we talked about it costing $18 million. This movie was never making any type of numbers that we're seeing today. You're talking about its widest release ever reaching was like 800 screens. When nowadays we see movies opening to like 3,000. Mm-hmm. It was definitely like indie. It was only making, you're talking about its opening weekend in 1984 making 500,000. That's it. 500,000. And it had like some sort of re-release in 2002. And it was only on like 18 screens. It made $86,000. That's not 800,000. That's 86,000. That's it. So that to me is sometimes so funny, because this movie did get such acclaim and so many people love it. But, and in my mind, so many people have seen it, but it never really made the money numbers. So I guess it makes sense why the studios weren't leaping for it when it was on the production table.
Yes, and also you mentioned near the beginning of the show, all the other 80s films that came out, those were comedies like Beverly Hills Cops.
Beverly Hillbillies. Yeah,
not something with a Beverly in it, you know.
The comedy movies that were really geared toward the younger teenage demographic. And if you watch Amadeus amongst all of those, you get the older demographic who can... not that you can be young and can't appreciate classical music, but I feel this movie is geared towards the older audience. Mm-hmm. And maybe not a lot of people would see it, because more people would be seeing the comedies at that time.
Amadeus makes me wonder, like, what movies are out now that we kind of, you know, don't recognize as much because they're not making that much money, that will last for years and years as fantastic films. I feel like somehow Whiplash has kind of cracked into the mass market knowledge versus like, and I think that's a very well-made movie. But you wonder, I mean, you look at last year where 12 Years a Slave won, but did not also make a lot of money. No. And this is a trend that sometimes happens. It just, you wonder which ones will last and will become things that, like JT, you watch in film school, things that you recognize as having great production value and worth learning from, and which ones you don't.
Well, can I just say, like, growing up, I always used to go to Blockbuster when they used to be around, and I would rent movies that ever had, they would have the little Best Picture logo in the corner of the VHS artwork. Mm-hmm. And I would always skip this movie because as a young kid, I would turn back, I'd look at the pictures, and you just see, like, all these people in these outfits. And as a teenager, you're like, do I want to get that? Or do I want to get something like Platoon or Rain Man with these stars that you know that have, like, you know, just, it's more appealing. I find, like, this is a movie you really probably aren't going to watch till you're older because there's not much selling. It just, you know, it really is age thing, I feel like. I appreciate this movie so much when I watched it as an adult, whereas I just skipped it because, you know, I was young and stupid.
I also don't think that when you look at the presentation of this movie, if you're just looking at, like, pictures and DVD covers or whatnot, and you're like, ah, it's about Mozart and classical music, that you're going to get the kind of the comedy factor that it has.
Oh, totally.
Like, none of that is... You wouldn't expect to laugh at all when watching this movie. I think you would expect a very heavy drama about an artist dying tragically young.
I always... Stanley Kubrick made a film called Barry Lyndon, which looks very similar to this movie production value-wise. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people consider it to be, like, one of his worst films because it's 3 hours, but it's very slow, very kind of a boring film. Mm-hmm. And a lot for me personally, whenever I would look, that movie just kind of put me off to movies like this. Gotcha. So I was always like, oh, Barry Lyndon, I can't take another movie like that.
Right. Well, I feel like there aren't many period pieces that do skirt this line between long drama and being funny. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about it. And some of the movies I'm about to name I do love. But if you're talking about, like, Anna Karenina that was super long and known for like being beautiful and being artistic and how it was filmed like a play, like so much critique, but you know, you're not gonna laugh during that film, or you're gonna talk about Pride and Prejudice, which girls love for a short story, but you're not gonna laugh. Like, there's not a lot out there that is period piece that is funny.
Yeah, and I think this film, again, it's not so much funny, but there were entertaining elements throughout. And I love the pacing of this film. For yes, it was 3 hours long, but it didn't really slow at any point where I lost my interest or whatnot. I was still very engaged in the characters, the story, what was going on. And every once in a while, we did get the fun scenes where Mozart is socializing with friends and playing piano. That's fun to watch. Would we laugh? Maybe. But even that's an added exciting element to it that, like, really balances out the seriousness of everything.
Yeah. Also, like, I totally understand, like, if I'm with a friend and we're at a place and I show him this movie, I understand it's a hard sell. Because I show, he's going to look at it, he's going to be like, 3 hours long, it's about Mozart, like, it takes place in these olden days, why am I not reading Die Hard 3? I'm like, I try to tell people, like, because I love this movie, I was like, you got to go in with an open mind and just kind of give yourself up to it, and you'll be surprised how great it is.
Yeah, it is hard, though. I think selling any movie that's 3 hours doesn't matter the reputation, doesn't matter how good it is. If it's 3 hours, it is a hard sell. It just is.
Yeah, nowadays, because
3 hours of reality TV, easy.
Well, but it's like I see what you're saying,
even
but
the time, the people's attention span doesn't last 3 hours long anymore, which is, it's really sad.
But I'll have an easier time selling a movie like Heat with De Niro and Pacino, which is 3 hours, or The Godfather. I could sell those to my friends a lot easier than I could sell Amadeus.
I think that all depends on who you're selling it to.
It really depends on who you're selling to. It also depends if any of them has seen them before. Because if you're trying to sell, like, The Godfather to someone who hasn't seen The Godfather, and get them to sit down, sometimes that argument doesn't also go over as well.
Also, it's a good point, is like, people just know what The Godfather is, even if they've never seen it. I feel like this movie is kind of forgotten for most, like, basic audiences.
Well, the thing is about The Godfather, there were so many memorable key moments and key scenes and key lines that people are always quoting The Godfather.
And actors like Pacino, Brando. Yeah, this, like, movie doesn't really have that.
I hear Godfather quote like every single week. It's still relevant, and that's like, that's how people keep that timely. So yes, people would probably be more inclined to see Godfather now if you're selling it against Amadeus. But the thing about Amadeus, why it's relevant, is that even back in the 1984, this was a time period piece. So you can go to this movie and watch it, enjoy it at any time of the year.
Yeah, same thing with, like, Godfather. It's a time period. I think these period films definitely helps their longevity. Because if it's something like, listen, there's a movie called Kramer vs. Kramer, which is a great movie.
Great movie.
But you feel like you're in 1970, whatever year they made it. So it does feel at some point it ages a little bit. But movies like French Connection, which won Best Picture in the early 70s. I love that movie, but there's certain things in that movie that remind you this was made in a time where things are different as far as, like, socially and, like, what was acceptable and what wasn't acceptable. So films like this, I think they last a little bit longer because of that.
Yeah, and the thing is, because people who lived 200 years ago aren't around anymore. So this is the type of film that people nowadays can go back to and enjoy and appreciate what went down at that time. People watching Godfather, watching French Connection, those periods, like, they're still alive. They remember those times. So in a way, it is timely, but it's still, people can still relate to it. And they're like, oh, they can have something to compare it to. When you watch Amadeus, they really don't have anything to compare it to because they haven't been around that time. Which,
time travel one day.
Time travel.
And then all movies will be relatable because you'll be able to go there and now movies will not be needed.
No. So what else about this film that really stuck to you that we haven't covered yet?
I feel like we've talked about themes, we've talked about movies, the music, we've talked about the actors. I could tell you they used mostly natural lighting, if you guys want to know that.
Talk about the director a little bit. Milos Forman, who
You can talk about the director a little bit.
You are a fan of Milos Forman.
I'm a fan of his early work. I believe two of my favorite films are Amadeus and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Both Best Picture winners, won a bunch of Oscars. And it's real curious on that, like, you know, in that decade he made two of my favorite films, but after that he was really picky with his projects. He did Man from the Moon with Jim Carrey. Mm-hmm. That was like his big...
That was in 1999.
Yeah, and before that he did The People vs. Larry Flint.
96.
Yep. So, and then he kind of hasn't really done much. He did a film with Javier Bardem a couple years ago with Natalie Portman, Goya's Ghost, I believe it was called.
Yep, right. Which 2006.
You know, not... That movie kind of made a... It was kind of a dud for him. Not a lot of people talked about it. I never saw it.
That was a period piece film.
Yeah, and I never actually saw it. Have you guys seen that one?
I have seen it.
What did you think?
There were a lot of visual graphic scenes that clearly are burned into my head. But overall, that was a long film, too. I enjoyed it for the period piece. I find all of his films have a great pacing that can still keep my attention. Despite how long the runtime is for a movie, I am still engaged throughout. And that's what I appreciate in a good director. If they can still keep their audience interested, then it's still an interesting movie.
Yeah, so a very interesting director. Like, if you told me the guy who directed The People vs. Larry Flint directed Amadeus, I'd probably be like, give you a double take. Okay. But I would like to see him do some more films, you know. But yeah, Amadeus and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, you got those two under your belt. You can retire as far as I'm concerned.
Right. I mean, he has kind of earned the right to be picky and choose whatever he wants to do. So I'm not going to fault him.
If you do want to see anything from him recently, it seems like he's a producer on a 2014 thing called A Short History of Decay, executive producer. Besides that, he has special things in...
Any upcoming projects?
Nosferatu. Nothing on IMDb noted. Doesn't mean that there isn't. That just doesn't mean that they're being reported on here. The only thing that is coming up even remotely, I guess, close, would be him playing his self on Ear of the Heart, the music of Galt McDermott and the Galt Project, which is a documentary, and he's an interviewee, and he's playing himself. So he's still, like, making the rounds. He definitely has executive producer credits. I'm sure people go to him for advice. He just hasn't really self-propelled anything. But,
I mean, he's 82. Yeah. So, I mean, he could be doing an Eastwood and just start making crazy movies, but... You know, listen, like I said, he's made some great films, so...
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Just a little bit more about the music, because this is about Mozart. We hear a lot of Mozart's composed music throughout all the fifth and second pieces and movements of Amadeus. I really appreciate it, because you know how some films just use slight, subtle transitions for music to get from one place to another? His music was constantly present. When he's writing, and that particular moment when he's pitching that opera that he doesn't want anyone to know, you could hear the music behind him that he's describing. When they're, again, writing, composing music at the end of it, you can hear it while they're doing it. It was such a key... I felt like the music itself was its own character.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it is. It's also his, like, heart. The good news about it is it's also, like, I believe it's all public domain. So we can keep hearing it, and keep being used in movies and music constantly, because it's free. So even new, young filmmakers can have this beautiful score if they want.
Let's make a Mozart movie.
Let's do this again.
We'll do a full farce. Comedy. Why not?
I mean, I appreciate the classical. I don't think anyone can ever mimic what Mozart had. His talent and ability is beyond anything that no one can touch. And that's just his character itself will live on and still has lived on. So, like, he will be present forever. He's a legend.
Oh, yeah.
Legend.
Well, he has a magical story, which is why they could make a movie out of it.
Yep.
Let's do a movie, Beethoven versus Mozart.
They do have a movie called Beethoven.
Do they really? That's with the dog.
I was going to say, it features a giant Saint Bernard.
Yeah, Charles
Bergen.
Wrong
type of Beethoven.
Beethoven II.
And just to let you know, young Beethoven is noted in Amadeus. While he is playing at a piano at a party, there's a young child who he smiles at, and the child nods back, and that is young Beethoven.
Oh, see, I don't remember that.
So they've been in a movie together. His character name is not listed. They speak no words, but that is who it is.
Interesting.
Nice.
Yes, random facts for you all, because he did know them, and...
I didn't know a dog could play piano.
Very funny.
All right, I really enjoyed this film. I'm glad that I came back a second time around, and I'm older enough to appreciate everything that went down, because it's a great film. Yeah. It really is.
I think sometimes it's good, like, we talk about these films as we talk about... As we talk about directors or actors, and we'll mention movies like Amadeus that started people's careers or that helped people's careers flourish. But sometimes I like that we get to go back and dive into them and talk about them and revisit them together instead of, you know, just watching them alone on Netflix.
Yes. And to add one more thing, that because the reason why we're doing it is Academy Awards. It was nominated for 11, won 4, Best Picture. For 1985. Mm-hmm. Best Actor, F. Murray Abraham, who plays Salieri.
And who competition was our other Tom, who played Amadeus. They're both fighting each other for this lead role. And Salieri finally won something.
Yes. Best Director, Best Actor. Oh, I already mentioned Best Actor. Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Sound Mixing, and Best Art Direction.
Also, let me just say, for Best Picture winner, some people say... Some Best Picture winners don't hold up. I feel like if this movie came out today, it would easily be in the Best Picture race. I think it's
okay. I agree. I agree with that. I think that it definitely it holds its spot. And
it would have beat Shakespeare in Love. Yeah. All time.
Best makeup
I
and
really
best
like Shakespeare in Love.
I love Shakespeare in Love.
Don't
Better than Saving Private Ryan. Thank
I like
Shakespeare. We covered Shakespeare in Love last year. Literally... Mm-hmm. Almost a year tomorrow.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Has been
yeah.
Shakespeare. Oh, Love.
Don't mess with me, Marissa, about Shakespeare Award in winner. Love. We love it.
I'm outnumbered here.
Yep. Yes, you are, and you are going to lose.
Because it's a funny period piece.
And yes, even about that film, how I loved how it does relate to this is that that was a story that you could see the main character having... you know, trouble writing, but how he got inspiration to write one of his best pieces
and
of work.
Also a culmination of all of some of his most wonderful plays, some of his most wonderful themes and storylines.
Yep.
A great combination for the genius of Shakespeare, JTE.
Just for the record, you would have voted for that over Saving Private Ryan?
Yes.
Sarah? Tick-tock.
That's a really hard question.
It is tough.
Because...
Not for me, but for you.
The thing that I do watch Saving Private Ryan actually quite a bit, but I watch Shakespeare in Love more.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard because this is a horrible parallel, but I'm going to use it. Like, for instance, my favorite movie of last year was Guardians of the Galaxy.
That is not Best Picture winner, though.
Exactly, but I wouldn't give it Best Picture. Does that make sense?
Gotcha, yeah.
There you go.
So it's hard for me because if I'm picking... one of my favorite movies from the year that came out, between Shakespeare in Love and Saving Private Ryan, I like Shakespeare in Love more.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if I would still vote for it for Best Picture.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I
so can
do
you see
that.
What I'm saying?
Yeah, I totally understand.
So it's like, sometimes I think there's a little bit of a difference between what I can acknowledge as being great and what I can acknowledge as I love.
Well, let me throw one more at you. And this is one that's debated a lot through film geeks.
Okay.
Forrest Gump or Pulp Fiction were up for Best Picture.
Forrest Gump won.
So you don't think Pulp Fiction should have
won? Forrest Gump.
Forrest Gump.
Oh, man. You guys are you're softies.
Yes.
Pulp Fiction was a great cultural movie as well, but Forrest Gump.
I thought that the story they intertwined for Forrest Gump to me was so fascinating.
Speaking of intertwined stories, Pulp Fiction, the way he redid the narrative.
I understand the narrative. I understand the cuts. I understand how they pulled together all these people. It was awesome. I'm not saying that I don't like Pulp Fiction. I'm saying that for me, Forrest Gump was just so inspirational. I loved the sound to it. I loved his character. I loved the acting. And how he took all these historical events and manipulated them into one for one man, I thought was beautiful.
Just for the record, I'm not mad with Forrest Gump winning. Okay. I love Forrest Gump, but I could totally make somebody... I can understand if somebody made an argument for Pulp Fiction.
All right, I get that. I get it.
For Amadeus winning against the four other nominations, that back in 1985, they were up against The Killing Fields, A Passage to India, Places in the Heart, and A Soldier's Story.
For me, it's... Would you put that? Here's the Amadeus thing. Amadeus by a mile, and not, I think it was actually a pretty weak year for Best Pictures, but that's not to diminish... Amadeus. I think if you take Amadeus and put it in a stronger year, it still would have had a really good chance of winning Best Picture.
I agree. And it did win.
That's sometimes what's hard about the thing, because you do get years where I can agree with you. I think that Amadeus was the clear winner this year, that year. But I think that there's other years where it does get harder. It does get, there's a movie that's just almost there.
Yeah, if I was going to that Best Picture race, like if I was at the Academy, I'd be like, no brainer, Amadeus has got this.
I mean, yes, can we do like some... all-star rounds of the Oscars.
I would love
Can that happen?
Yeah, put like the best movies up against each other.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like Oscar all-stars by decade. You know?
We're going to do Oscar all-stars.
Yeah, exactly.
We're pitching
and like
our idea
all
now.
The Oscars from like the 70s are going to compete, and then all the Oscars from like the 80s are going to compete.
It's a great idea.
And 90s. Then it's going to be a huge thing. I like it.
And then it's like decades against each other.
Just in time for March Madness.
Perfect timing. We'll work on this.
Perfect timing. It's a work in progress. So, great film. I highly suggest anyone who hasn't seen Amadeus, but you're listening to us, so I'm assuming you have, but you should definitely just take a revisit to Amadeus.
Tell your friends to see it.
Yes, take a revisit
to... Because I did, and I appreciated it the second time around.
Take a revisit to a lot of your Best Picture noms and winners. We're going to be revisiting more of them. I'm really on board for this decade's Oscar showdown. There might be a poster board involved.
Great.
It's going to be fun.
I'm excited for that. So thank you all for listening and enjoying this conversation. Sarah, you are not on Twitter. No. But can you let everyone know where they can follow all of us?
You can follow us on Facebook and on Popcorn Talk Network on our YouTube channel. Subscribe, rate, comment, do all those fun things. Also, we do have a Twitter handle, but I don't really... It's at Popcorn Talk. No, at the Popcorn Talk?
At Popcorn Talk.
Oh, okay. See, I'm not good at Twitter. I don't have one.
For Anatomy of a Movie, you can follow us on Twitter and on iTunes and all those fun places at Movie Anatomy. And on iTunes is at Anatomy of a Movie. And you can follow me everywhere here at Popcorn Talk. I do Anatomy. I every once in a while see the box office shows. It's fun because I'm a part of engineering that.
JT! We and do a box JT, office show.
Yes, JT and Sarah, check them out.
Box office breakdown.
Box office breakdowns every Monday. That's a fun show. Thank you all for listening. Keep rating, keep subscribing, keep commenting. We love it all. Tell us what your favorite movies were for the past Academy Award winners. We'd like to see. Maybe we'll see the Academy Award winning showdown. That would be fun to watch. Thank you all for listening. We will see you for our next film.
Braveheart will win everything.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.